This is Ashoka Changemakers, brought to you by the Innovate Podcast in collaboration with Ashoka and Arch Street Press. Here's your host, Robert Rim.
There's a growing wave of conscious consumerism in our world. Shoppers are educating themselves in the origins of what they buy, and businesses want to mitigate potential risks in their supply chain while making a positive impact. The choices we make as consumers have a profound economic, environmental, and social impact, and although the United States represents just 5% of the world's population, we consume 29% of the world's resources. Today we'll be talking with Paul Rice, President, Founder, and CEO of Fairtrade USA, an organization committed to changing how global trade works, and the leading certifier of Fairtrade products in North America. Paul founded Fairtrade USA in 1998, after spending 11 years organizing farmers in the highlands of Nicaragua. His firsthand experience over the last 30 years in the areas of sustainable agriculture, grassroots economic development, global supply chain transparency, and consumer activism is really unique in the certification world. He's now a leading advocate of impact sourcing as a core strategy for both poverty alleviation and sustainable business. Paul's been honored for his pioneering work by Ashoka, the Schwab Foundation for Social Entrepreneurship, and the Skoll Foundation. He holds economics and political science degrees from Yale University and an MBA from the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley, where he's now an executive fellow. He's spoken at the World Economic Forum, Clinton Global Initiative, Skoll World Forum, TEDx, and numerous universities and conferences around the world. And in October 2018, Fairtrade USA celebrated its 20th anniversary. Paul, welcome to Innovate Podcast.
Robert, thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Let's start with your own story, Paul. Your entrepreneurial spirit showed itself early in your life. How did that come about? And what started your interest in trade and sustainable development?
It came from my family. I was raised by a single mom, and she grew up on a farm in Oklahoma during the Great Depression. In fact, her family lost their farm during the Great Depression, and life was hard. And my mother and her sisters grew up in abject poverty. I heard those stories a lot as I was growing up. And so I have always felt a connection and a close affinity to farming folk and to how hard and precarious life can be down on the farm. And so I guess I've just always felt a connection there and always wanted to support farmers and support sustainable development in whatever way I could.
And you really saw that firsthand in Nicaragua, didn't you?
I did, yeah. So I studied economics and political science in college. I was interested in sustainable development then. I was kind of baffled by the reality of poverty and hunger in a world of plenty. And it didn't seem right. Didn't seem inevitable. It seemed like something that could be changed. And so straight out of college, I bought a one-way ticket to Nicaragua, and I went off to work with farmers and thought I would stay for a year or two. But in the end, I ended up staying for 11 years, working way up in the mountains in very remote rural communities with small family farmers and trying to help them.
And that's not a common choice, is it, buying a one-way ticket to Nicaragua straight out of college?
No, I suppose not.
Yeah. And about Nicaragua, that brings to mind the global trade model. And Fairtrade USA is designed to benefit farmers, workers, fishermen, consumers, industry, and the earth itself by certifying and promoting fair trade products. Tell us about this model and how it's become so effective.
The origins of fair trade go back to the 1950s when folks in Europe launched this idea that you could help poor folks around the world more effectively if you just paid a decent price for the things that they produced and that you didn't need to send them charity. And in fact, the slogan at the time for the fair trade movement was trade, not aid. And it was this notion that if we just give people a decent price for their coffee or their tea or bananas or whatever it is that they're growing, they will have the resources to invest in their families and their communities and protect the environment around them. And so the work that we are developing here with the fair trade movement in the United States definitely builds on this 60-year global movement around fair trade. And in essence, it is a movement that is trying to solve poverty and promote sustainable development, and to do that through a market-based approach. So we form partnerships with companies, and we educate consumers to choose fair trade products. And when they do, more money gets back to the farmer and the worker, right? So essentially, it's a way for you and me and other shoppers to directly contribute to the livelihoods of farmers and directly contribute to environmental protection through our daily shopping habits. And if you break that down, what it means is our farmers and factory owners around the world are adhering to a rigorous set of over 200 fair trade standards that govern how they treat their labor, that govern their environmental impact. And so when farms and factories meet that rigorous fair trade standard and pass their annual audit, they get certified as a fair trade facility and are eligible then to sell to any one of our 1,400 buyers here in the United States. We're working with companies large and small, from Whole Foods to Walmart, from Honest Tea to Green Mountain Coffee to Dole Bananas. I mean, we're working with some of the leading buyers of consumer products and particularly food products. And they are paying more money back to the fair trade farmers and workers and then putting the fair trade seal, the fair trade certified seal on their products so that when you and I see them at the store, we know what that means.
And you mentioned investing in their families and communities. Empowering the workforce behind the products we buy is so central to your overall mission, isn't it?
Oh, it sure is. You know, we believe that the people on the ground in the communities, farmers and workers themselves, know their own needs best. And so rather than telling them that they need a school or a health center or a daycare center in their community, we have an empowerment model through which farmers and workers organize themselves and do their own community needs assessment. And then they debate that and they discuss it and they have to kind of democratically vote and choose where they're going to spend the premium dollars that they receive through fair trade in their community each year. And so in one community that I visited recently, they chose to invest in scholarships to send their kids on to high school and college. High school is technically free, but you need uniform money and you need shoes in order to go to high school. And so this scholarship fund, a modest $200 a year per kid, was set up to help kids that couldn't afford their uniforms and their shoes to buy that and be able to access high school. In another community, they invested in healthcare. In other communities, they invest in training so that their farmers can convert their farms to organic cultivation. So every community chooses, and this is kind of the heart of what we call empowerment, the notion that families and communities know their own needs best, and so they're the best ones to kind of direct the investments that are being made through fair trade sales.
And in talking about these people on the ground, tell us about someone connected to fair trade whose story really demonstrates the transformative power of what fair trade does.
One family that I've been close to for many years is the Rivera family in northern Nicaragua. Santiago Rivera is a 66-year-old coffee farmer. Very typical of coffee farmers around the world. So he's third generation. His grandparents were coffee farmers. His parents were coffee farmers. He's a coffee farmer. He only has 1 acre of coffee. So he's very typical of the 30 million families around the world that today grow coffee. And Santiago grew up poor. Like most coffee farmers, his family struggled to make ends meet. So he went to school through second grade, learned how to read and write, and then at the age of 9, he was out in the fields helping his family. Very, very typical of that generation. His kids came up, and Santiago and his wife were not able to send them to high school, and so they were able to study through sixth grade in the local village school, and then they had to go to work on the farm as well. But his youngest daughter, Yolanda, had kind of a different life journey, because by that time, Santiago had joined a cooperative in his community, a group of about 40 other families. And they, in turn, had joined a fair trade group in northern Nicaragua and had started to sell their coffee at a much better price to global fair trade buyers. And so they decided to set up a scholarship fund. Yolanda, his daughter, went on to high school thanks to that scholarship fund. Then she went on to college thanks to that scholarship fund. So think about it. You and I are buying fair trade coffee, and one cup at a time, one penny at a time, we're contributing to this community and giving girls like Yolanda Rivera a chance to go to high school, to go to college, and to totally write a new story for themselves. In Yolanda's case, she became a health professional. She's a lab technician. She's back in her community working in the health center there and contributing to better community health. And so not only has she written a whole new future for herself, but just as importantly, she is a role model for all the girls in that village who now get to dream of being more than a farmer's daughter and more than a farmer's wife. They get to dream of being anything they want thanks to this simple model of you and me buying fair trade coffee and giving them the resources to change their lives.
And being a role model directly inspires so many other people, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. That also is the essence of what we think of as empowerment, this notion that people in the communities around the world have the ability, with just a helping hand, have the ability to completely transform their lives and in the process become a role model for the next generation and inspire the next generation to pursue their dreams and to dream big.
And now, a word from Arch Street Press. Created by a diverse group of chefs, nutritionists, and food activists, Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community offers strategies to rebuild the connection between diet, culture, faith, the environment, and community well-being, with a focus on the deep connection between mindful eating, social justice, and sustainability. Through powerful storytelling and thoughtful analysis, the essays in Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community explore the historical and cultural shifts that have affected the way we eat. These essays provide the starting points for conversations to help us reframe our relationship with food to allow for physical, emotional, and spiritual healing. With one seed empowered, many trees take root.
And now back to Paul and Robert.
You mentioned earlier about your partnerships with over 1,300 companies, which is so great to hear this kind of awareness. Market leaders like Green Mountain, Starbucks, General Mills, Pepsi, Whole Foods, Costco, Target, Walmart, and it goes on. How do these partnerships work?
We reach out to companies in all of the product categories where we're working. And you know, we started 20 years ago just certifying coffee. But over the years, we have started certifying now a total of over 40 different products. You'll find fair trade coffee and tea. We also certify sugar and chocolate and rice and quinoa. We certify about 20 different fruits and vegetables, from bananas and pineapples to tomatoes and bell peppers. We recently started certifying fish. A few years ago, we started certifying apparel and home goods like rugs and furniture. So the companies that come to us in these various product categories agree to a couple of things. First of all, they agree to buy from fair trade certified farms and factories and to pay a premium price, so an above market price that goes back to the community and that funds these community investments that we've been talking about. And then the companies that we work with also agree to open their books and allow themselves to be audited and to let us verify that they're paying this fair trade price. So over the years, we have managed to attract some of what I would argue are the most enlightened and progressive companies in the United States to our movement. And you just mentioned some of them. In each product category, you know, I really feel fortunate to be able to work with companies that are really walking the talk and making this whole notion of business with purpose a reality. I think, you know, we're seeing the dawn of a new age in global capitalism where, if in the past business leaders saw a trade-off between profitability on the one hand and sustainability on the other, right? So you could be profitable or you could be sustainable, but you couldn't be both. I think that trade-off mentality dominated business thinking in the past. But today, I see a shift. Today, I see business leaders increasingly realizing that that's a false trade-off and that, in fact, sustainability and profitability can go together. And in many cases, sustainability can actually drive business success. And that's what we're seeing in fair trade. And I believe that's part of the reason why so many companies have joined our movement in recent years. It's because what companies are realizing is that when they, for example, pay coffee farmers a higher price, what they get in return is a better quality product. It's a cliche, but it's true. You get what you pay for. So if you're paying a really low price to the coffee farmer, you can't really expect much in terms of quality. But if you pay a higher price and that gets all the way back down to the farmers, then they're able to invest in the quality of their farms, the quality of the product. And so they're able to deliver a consistently higher value product back. And so it's truly a win-win for companies that are participating in models like fair trade. And I would argue that, you know, there's a third win. It's win-win-win because the consumer also gets value out of this kind of transaction. What do we get as consumers? We get higher quality products. We also get to feel good, right? There's emotional value in knowing that there's no child labor in the products that we buy, that there's no environmental destruction in the products that we buy, and that in fact families and the environment were protected and served. So I see a growing movement in the business community. We call it conscious capitalism. So it's the notion that business leaders are really driving purpose and sustainability into their business models. And we also see conscious consumerism on the rise. Ordinary consumers like you and me asking, where does my product come from? Where does my food come from? Tell me the story and reassure me that it's sustainable.
And as you're talking, a quote of yours comes to mind. I used to think that markets were the problem. And through fair trade, I came to see that markets could be our ally. They really can be a key ally, can't they?
They can. You know, it was really interesting to discover this 30 years ago back in Nicaragua when I was organizing farmers there, because what we discovered was that the local middleman was only going to pay around 10 to 15 cents a pound for our coffee. But if we were able to get organized and export direct and kind of jump over all the middlemen in the local market and go direct to the global market with a high quality product, we could get over a dollar a pound for our coffee, so 10 times more. And so that was the ideological shifting point for me in realizing that markets aren't inherently evil. They can be good for people. They can be bad for people. So the task then becomes, how do we organize the poor? How do we organize farmers and workers around the world and train them to navigate the global market and be successful in the global market as competitors and as successful business people in that environment? And that really has led me to commit my efforts, my career, and my personal mission to this fair trade movement and to this bigger notion that sustainable sourcing and markets in general can be a huge opportunity to promote sustainable livelihoods and sustainable development.
And in bringing products to market, tell us about impact sourcing and its effect on local economies and workers.
Yeah, so the term impact investing has been around for a while, and it's the notion that it makes a difference where you invest your money, and you can invest your money for social and environmental impact. So impact sourcing is kind of a similar concept. It's the notion that how businesses source their products, whether it's apparel from India or coffee from Nicaragua or bananas from Brazil, how companies buy those products, how they source those products is meaningful in terms of the impact on the communities that make those products and the environment from which they come. And so impact sourcing is the notion that businesses here can not only source great coffee and bananas and apparel from a quality perspective, but they can also have a positive environmental and social impact if they adhere to certain practices. And I would say the core pillars of impact sourcing are transparent supply chains where companies are sourcing directly from producers, creating more transparency around middlemen and reducing the number of middlemen in the supply in the transaction, number one. And then number two, rewarding farms and factories that produce in a more sustainable and responsible manner. So I think one of the mistakes in the past was that companies created codes of conduct for their suppliers overseas. And they said, okay, here's the code of conduct. Don't do all these bad practices. Don't employ children and don't pollute the environment. And whatever costs associated with that are your problem. So the market and the companies up here weren't willing to help bear the cost of that, of those practices. I think more enlightened approaches now, like fair trade and what we might call impact sourcing, recognize that there's a cost involved and that that cost should be shared. And so companies are increasingly finding ways to support their suppliers in becoming more sustainable.
And that directly impacts decent living wages and safe working conditions, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. If we look at, I don't know, the last 20, 30 years, what we've seen is that a lot of companies up here have beat up on suppliers around the world to deliver the cheapest possible product. And that puts workers in harm's way. That really limits the ability of workers to get a decent living wage and to provide for their families and their communities. And so this emerging mindset in the business community, this mindset around impact sourcing, if you will, or ethical trade, ethical sourcing, fair trade, these are all part of an emerging mentality that the goal of business isn't necessarily to extract the cheapest product out of their developing world suppliers, but rather to get a high quality product that also provides enough money to those suppliers to pay their workers a decent wage. And that in turn will create actually a much more secure and reliable supply chain. And it will reduce the risk of, a reputational scandal, because no company up here, no U.S. company wants to have a child labor scandal associated with their products. I remember a few years ago, the Rana Plaza tragedy, where a major factory in Bangladesh collapsed, over 1,000 workers were killed. It was one of the largest tragedies in the apparel industry. This was a factory that made apparel for all kinds of U.S. and global brands. And there are no more secrets in the global supply chain. When a tragedy like that happens, it's front page news. Everyone hears about it. And then consumers are asking companies, well, what did you do to help stop tragedies like this? What are you doing to help prevent them in the future? So I think increasingly consumers are holding companies accountable. And I think companies are going to look for ways to not race to the bottom in terms of labor practices. They're going to look for ways to make sure that factories are safer and more responsible for all kinds of reasons.
And that accountability aspect clearly extends to the environment. The environmental piece of your mission is altogether crucial. Tell us about the connection between simultaneously protecting the environment, consumer awareness, and trade.
Yeah, we believe that poverty alleviation and environmental stewardship go together. And farmers have this wisdom without being told. They know that if they are able to protect their soils and to protect the water sources and the forests around their farms, that that's going to enable them to be more productive on their farms and to sustain a decent living through their farm. So there's a connection between sustainable livelihoods or decent living and environmental stewardship. And so we've driven that logic into our standards. So the fair trade standard, a lot of people think of fair trade as just a decent living wage for farmers and workers, but it also has very rigorous standards around environmental stewardship and agricultural practices. We don't allow the worst agricultural chemicals that are often used in these in different countries around the world. We require that farmers protect forests around their farms and protect their soils and reinvest in soil productivity. So these are all part of the fair trade model, and they have a positive impact not just on the environment and ideally in helping to slow climate change, but they also have a positive impact on the livelihoods of our farmers and their communities.
Thank you.
And now, a word from Arch Street Press. In its review, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal had this to say about Gendership 1.0, Beyond Leadership Toward Liberating the Creative Soul. David Castro's book does something courageous that we haven't seen before in this genre. He questions the very concept of leadership itself, thinking through its limitations. He meditates on specific and interrelated organizational practices central to creativity within groups: listening, co-thinking, co-visioning, relationships, conflict and learning, systems thinking, creativity, and group dynamics. Castro invites us to think about ways this community practice of creativity is central to human progress and even to human identity.
And now back to Paul and Robert.
You're putting this into practice with your own products. Tell us about the growth in your apparel and home goods sector, such a prime initiative that's bringing the proven fair trade model from the farm to the factory.
Apparel has been a great new chapter in our story. We started with food products, and we were only certifying food products for our first 15 years. My background is in agriculture, and I actually never imagined that fair trade would move into the world of apparel and home goods and other factory-made products. But we started to get calls from leading apparel brands saying to us, our code of conduct approach is not really getting the job done. Labor is still being exploited. We still see poverty in the communities around our factories. We are still concerned about safety in the factories. We're wondering if you can modify the fair trade model for food products and adapt it to make it relevant to the world of factories. So after hearing this for a few years, we decided to test that hypothesis that fair trade could have a meaningful impact on the lives of workers in a factory setting. We developed a draft standard. We piloted it. We had a multi-stakeholder dialogue in which we got the activists and the unions and the brands and the retailers and consumer groups. We got them all in the same room, and we looked at the standard. We looked at the pilot results, and we ended up launching our standard then a couple of years later. And one of the first companies to sign with us was Patagonia. And Patagonia is a well-known brand for its environmental concern and its environmental impact. And they were looking for a way to complement that with a stronger position with regard to workers. Patagonia is going deep. They've converted now literally hundreds of styles to fair trade. We've certified now, I think, about 40% of their factories, and every year we certify more. And that in turn led to other brands joining us. So now we're working with Prana, we're working with Athleta, we're working with Target, we're working with J.Crew and Madewell. And so a number of different leading apparel brands have joined our cause because they see that fair trade is a way for them to get greater visibility into factory conditions, greater transparency. It's a way to raise the bar in terms of worker safety and health. It's a way for them to get more money back to the workers so that they can improve their livelihoods. And finally, it gives them a way to tell a story, because we have a fair trade certified seal, which is being put on all the products that we certify. So you'll see it now on apparel. And that gives brands a way to tell the consumer that this is a more responsible product and to feel good about it. So we're really excited about the rapid growth in our apparel program. It's complemented by a similar growth in what we call our home goods program. So companies like West Elm and Pottery Barn and Target, who are certifying rugs and furniture and home furnishings. And it's a similar issue there with the apparel program. We're working with workers in factories in India and Sri Lanka, Vietnam, China, and now here in the United States as well. And the mission there, again, is to serve those workers and to protect the environment and the neighboring communities.
Such a broad scope. And as fair trade moves forward on multiple fronts, what are some of the challenges you see that may in the long run be opportunities for novel solutions?
I would say the biggest challenge we face today is consumer awareness and product availability. The awareness of the fair trade label has grown steadily over the years. In fact, right now, 63% of American adults recognize the fair trade certified label and say they've seen it. But only about 20% of American adults, according to the research, indicate that they're actually buying fair trade products on either a regular or occasional basis. Now, 20% of American shoppers, that's over 40 million people. So that's a huge following, a huge community that we've built. But I think the biggest obstacle for them is not finding fair trade products at the stores where they shop. So that's a challenge for us. There's a great selection of fair trade products at Whole Foods. There's a growing selection of fair trade products at other more mainstream retailers like Kroger and Safeway, Costco, Sam's Club, Walmart, Target, and so on. But, you know, I think that's really the biggest challenge is how do we raise consumer awareness around fair trade? How do we build understanding of what it means? And then how do we get more products out into mainstream retailers so that when people go to their local store, they see fair trade products and it's easy for them to buy? You know, one of the things that the research indicates is that most people won't go out of their way. They won't make a special trip to a different store just to buy a fair trade product. So what that means is fair trade needs to be in every store. It needs to be in every store where folks shop. And so that's our goal. That's our mission right now, to form stronger partnerships with the retail community, with supermarkets, and to promote the launching of fair trade products in every supermarket in the country. And I think if we can do that, then we'll dramatically boost fair trade product sales, which in turn drives impact for farmers and for workers all around the world.
And Paul, for those in our audience who want to go forward from this podcast and make better choices, what advice would you have for them to become more informed consumers?
The power is in our hands as consumers, whether it's fair trade or organics, buy local, non-GMO, sustainable forestry, sustainable fishery. You know, there's so many different product certifications and product labels that all carry different sustainability attributes. Those sustainability movements only succeed if you and I as shoppers go out, look for those labels and buy those products and reward those companies for what they're doing. So I think for our listeners who are interested in doing more, the first call to action is simply to look for those sustainability labels, to look for the fair trade label, and to choose that product whenever you can. Secondly, I would say we need to inform ourselves as consumers about the issues. And, you know, one of the things that we know about the conscious consumer is that she is curious. She educates herself. She reads the label on the product. If there's something there that she doesn't understand, she goes home and does the research online, and then she spreads the word among her friends. So as curious and conscious consumers, I would just encourage folks to research the issues and to choose products that are more responsibly made and more sustainably made, and to support companies that are doing that. And then finally, I would say join the movement. Spread the word. In Fair Trade, we have built a grassroots consumer movement on college campuses around the country and in local communities around the country. So we have Fair Trade towns, Fair Trade universities all over the country, and it's really easy to join them and to get involved. And the mission of those local community groups is to spread the word about fair trade products and to get them into local stores and make fair trade products more available. So it's a real concrete way for folks to plug in and to make a tangible difference in supporting the fair trade movement and in getting more benefits back to farmers and workers. I'll just give you one example. Texas A&M, one of the largest universities in the country with over 60,000 students, they just became a fair trade campus. And it took about 9 months of organizing, but a group there got Texas A&M involved, and they met a series of criteria to become a fair trade campus, which includes getting fair trade coffee into their dining halls and other fair trade products into their cafes and offices on campus. They got the university to approve a declaration of support for fair trade, and they're getting fair trade into the curriculum by they've written several case studies of fair trade impact, and that's being now used in various classrooms. And so based on all that work, they were declared a fair trade campus. And that has a huge ripple effect, because Now those students, as they graduate, they'll go out into the world looking for fair trade products with greater knowledge of fair trade products. And that in turn builds the market and builds the movement. So we're really excited about those fair trade groups in towns and on campuses around the country. And we're excited about consumers getting involved and joining the movement in order to help us build it.
And through all of these means, the power is surely in our hands. And on that inspiring note, listeners can find out more about the organization at fairtradecertified.org. Paul, good to talk with you today, and all the best in continuing to bring fair trade's vision to so many on both sides of the aisle.
Well, thank you so much, Robert. I really appreciate your efforts to get the word out.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Innovate is produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, this has been Innovate.